Blog Talk Radio.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.
Welcome to Break On Through. Here you can travel realms uncharted, blur the lines, break the chains, open yourself to possibilities waiting to be discovered on the other side. I am Pam Ray, and with me is my co-host, Intimidus Rex. Rex and I are poets on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. And if you find that this show is not your cup of tea, please check out our other shows. We have 1 to 2 shows per night on a variety of styles of topics and poetry, something to suit everybody's taste. Also, make sure when you get a chance to check out the poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets on Amazon, because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. And hello, Rex. How goes it?
Well, all right. What's good?
Oh, just, you know, enjoying life. Nice, cool, mild temp. A fairly productive day. Plenty of caffeine. Life is good. And looking forward to delving into tonight's poetry. We've got a great lineup, and of course, as always, looking forward to hanging out with you and maybe some other cool poets. I see Quicken on the board, I Darkened Auras on the board, and I see Silent Tree. So hello to all of them. I see Darkened Auras is having some storms in her area, so fingers crossed and prayers sent out there that, it's not too hard, as far as storms go. Hopefully it'll keep things mild and the electricity on.
There's nothing quite like a hurricane down in Florida.
Oh, my goodness gracious. That has to be just insane.
Oh, it is. The hurricane comes in and says to the coconut tree, hang on to your
balls, this ain't going to be no ordinary Botox.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some pretty bad storms. I've never seen a hurricane, and I can only imagine the experience and what it must be like to see that kind of force of nature. That's wow. And we have Aaron's Panther listening in from down under. Very cool. Hello, Aaron. Good to see you. Dark Indoors says, I love storms, just not if the power gets knocked out. You know what? I have to agree with that. I do. You know, they are a wonder to behold, but man.
You just got to look at it another way. Watch out for those lightning strikes outside the light of the sky and listen to the tinkling of the rain on the roof because there ain't no other sound in the house.
Well, yeah, and I suppose you could also look at it as a great opportunity to light some candles and, you know, either get romantic or put a curse on somebody, depending on, you know, which you prefer doing. So there's always a positive spin. Yeah. So for tonight's topics, we actually have two contests, and it's a little bit darker than we would normally have on Break On Through. Although Break On Through, we do a wide variety. Oftentimes, though, I do tend to lean more towards abstract and surrealism, but we had some carryovers, which kept getting moved from the contest with quotes from the 1986 movie The Fly. And so, you know, I didn't want to wait another week for those. So we have those up, which were originally intended for a dark show. And then we have the art of Boris Groh and his artwork. I considered putting on a dark show because if you look at it, it does have a dark vibe, a dark theme to it, which, by the way, I really recommend. Anybody who hasn't checked out his artwork really should. But the more I looked at his artwork, because a lot of it tells a story. It's very post-apocalyptic. There's monsters and what looks like aliens and interacting with humans. And there's such stories to the whole of his art pieces, the collections, and also to the individual art, and such a fascinating way, like, of putting the interacting of the characters together that, to me, had a broader message than just darkness. And I don't say just darkness as to mean that I'm belittling darkness, but from my personal observations and my personal feelings about the artwork of Boris Groh, I could not put it on the dark show. I thought, you know, if people write dark, obviously that's absolutely fine because you look at his artwork and it can definitely take you in that direction. But I wanted it to be on a Break On Through show. So I was really pleased with the outcome for tonight's show, quality and quantity. And I'm definitely looking forward to it. So with that being said, all right, Rex, let's go ahead and get this party started.
Well, you get The Mortuary Waits by La Belle Rouge.
All right. The Mortuary Waits by La Belle Rouge. The mortuary waits with its vacuums and formaldehyde. And unless you are the embalmer, you must be dead to come inside. The stitching of eyes and lips, your blood seeps down the drain. But since you're dead, my darling, you'll be feeling no more pain. The grave has been excavated or the mausoleum opened wide, welcoming what is left of you to the silent world inside. They say your brain is gone, gelled into a gruesome goo. But do the dead still think? No one really knows, it's true. The dirt has been piled high, 6 feet of it on the ground, covered with lovely green grass. When at last they lower you down, your stone reads rest in peace, and it's possible you might, unless you're among the dead who walk abroad on Samhain night. And poem, what an absolutely wonderful dark rite. And Rex, your thoughts?
I like the tone. That first stanza kind of fits nice. The mortuary waits with its vacuums and formaldehyde. Unless you are the embalmer, you must be dead to come inside. That's nice opening up there. Then rolling in with the stitching of eyes and lips, the draining of the blood. Great way to start the piece, but I like that third one. They say your brain is gone, jellied into gruesome goo, but do the dead still think? No one really knows. It's true. I like that too, because I remember the Egyptians used to use a copper wire, which they stick up the nose, had a hook on it, and they puncture through the nasal cavity into the brain and twirl that little copper wire around until the brain was turned into mush, and then they'd raise the head up so it could drain out as part of their ritual for the dead. So we haven't come that far in all these years yet, except for the machinery itself. Otherwise, it's usually cutting the body open and taking everything out, which you still do, and then stuff it up with newspapers to keep it up, formaldehyde for the embalming process. But they used to do it with natron and then oils and herbs for keeping the flesh fresh. So this is a little different. I like it. And the back end, that note to, unless you're wondering, one of those wandering souls for Halloween, that note of the 13th hour, walking out that witching.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great observations there, Rex. Yeah, I really like this. As you said, it has a great tone to it. I like the rhyme within the first stanza. It has a nice flow to it, and the imagery, which becomes really visceral, which I like. And I also like the dark humor, you know, within your blood seeps down the drain, but since you're dead, my darling, you'll be feeling no more pain. And I like how the first, two stanzas speak on the reality of death, the physical reality of death, and all that's done to prepare your body for burial. And then it goes into the philosophy of death within that third stanza, especially with the question, but do the dead still think? No one knows it's true. And the idea of what is the human spirit capable of? Of course, I do believe human spirits have some form of thinking. They don't have all the synapses and stuff, but I truly believe that every human has a spirit, and that spirit is capable of form of thinking. But everybody believes differently as far as what happens after death. But I like the philosophy in that and the pondering. And then I like how the end stanza, especially those last lines, remind us that there's a spiritual element that especially on times of the year where the veil is thin between the living and the dead. And so bringing in the spiritual element of Samhain night and the dead walking abroad on there, I thought was a really great ending. I thought she really embraced the entirety of death and the potential of what it means. So excellent write and very well done. And what do we got next?
We have Run, My Friend, Oscar Kafka by Peter Solway. Meat in the cupboard at the lights out, cover of scuttling dark under the U-bend. Discuss our sordid alienations, agreeing with thin antlers on lonely theme. Lack of inner strength. Ice picks never enough to thaw our separate frozen hearts. Waves separate limbs break apart. Footsteps of brutal humans. Our basement door too widen kitchen flooding. Ugliest bugs once human like them, reduced to hiding, loveless egg-laying, compulsory spraying, in the dark and fighting, sad existence under the U-bend fronds. Fronds to mourn, my condemned companion, tired escaping promised land beyond, now long gone to cat and boot, a squash black champion, once idealism, now exploded guts and champagne. The evil ants to come, march through open kitchen, and last narrator in fetid surrounds, hungry earth under you bend, fetid with excommunication, poked with spray can. Unrobed him to eat, get drunk, last at a bug surveyors, imprisoned in bagon prison, in solitary wisdom, coughing my last first person. No more to lust after summits of scraps, feasts of dead rats, existential deadlines, pantries beyond eulogies of a meaningless life. A small brain thought on complex mortality, Shakespeare low on few without evidence, without audience, cognition not much to spark, only task of gut going, primal fleeing under that recall you bend. Nights of no resistance, broken glass and Gaza pass, demolition, COVID in civic lockdown, happy doctors with masks on, even happier Jews, sons of circumcision. Remember the once proud Franz, though love and foreskin gone, a copper eulogy to sound, memory stands its ground, bug and writer as one. Gentile and Jew embracing, fleeing Panosthenes, picnicking, surfing the Mediterranean, gas attack screams, wild Fred Owen. Oh no, please conflict stop at least slow, my tiny cup against you bend, bout the earth's bolted fate to ring, cavernous and dark, as a giant woman descends. Queen of fat on white porcelain throne, a suffocating specimen under greater jurisdiction, of less than peasants, crabs on scrotums, flushed to toxic oceans, storms of unfortunate duration. Suds of recent radiation, offspring all gassed, eight legs instead of six, propaganda instead of science, nothing pleasant for last roach-scribing truth. A bug's life full of defecation, no dedication, paranoidal education, grand ancestors alien, flatulent with non-existence, chant of flushing drains, hiking in long jumps back to sacred room. Franz with father all alone, once upon a truth-telling time, me with a mop of shoving mother, handprints in the garden, spider hidden, a silken sketch of another morn. And poem.
Wow, great read there, Rex. Very cool. As always, I'm impressed with Peter's imagery, metaphors, hard-hitting lines, wordplay. I like the nod, obviously, to Franz Kafka and his book, Metamorphosis. And I like how, to me, Peter compares different types of people to different types of insect. And, you know, I feel like this speaks on, as I interpreted, on the changing times of humanity and how I often say it's not always for the best. Metamorphosis isn't always something beautiful. I felt like a loveless egg-laying, compulsionary spraying in the dark, confiding, sad existence under the U-bend fronds. Were powerful lines on a life lived without finding your purpose. I also like where he says, no more to lust after sonnets of scraps, feasts of dead rats, existential deadlines, palm trees beyond, eulogies of a meaningless life. I thought, you know, really just to me spoke on that whole idea of how we ponder the same things over and over again, never moving on to the potential of new thoughts. But then also the thought that I mean, all the way through, there's great lines, and there's lines on the ugliness of this world, the brutality of this world. I liked COVID and civic lockdown, happy doctors with masks on, even happier Jews, sons of circumcision. Thought-provoking line, but I especially got a kick out of Queen of Fat on White Porcelain Throne, a suffocating specimen under greater jurisdiction of less than peasants, crabs on scrotums flushed to toxic oceans, storms of unfortunate duration. It often seems like, you know, like people, ugly people, when I say ugly, obviously not physically ugly, but emotionally ugly people want to share that ugliness. They want to spread it like a disease. I also like how this also references, you know, sexually transmitted diseases and the idea of living in a world where we don't, unfortunately, we've become indifferent to caring about what negativity and what diseases we pass along. You know, just an amazing write all the way through and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to take the literality off the top of that. That first stanza hits on the idea of cockroaches. Meet in the cupboard after lights out. Cover a scuttling dog under the U-bend. Discuss our sordid alienation, agreeing with thin antlers. On lonely theme, lack of inner strength, the idea of humanity, well, most of humanity being reduced to the cockroaches scuttling around in the dark because those, the Lord and Master, those who strike a larger routine of telling people who and what they are and what they're supposed to do are the ones, like he says, the Pope with a spray can now exploded guts. The celebration with champagne, and then the evil ants to come march through open kitchen and last narrated and fetid surrounds hungry earth under U-bend. U-bend keeps coming back as that note to the U in the pipes where you get a little bit of moisture, where typically the roaches and silverfish and what none such collect, kind of refers to us in that notion, because he hits on the idea later down with bug and writer is one, but there was another piece. What's it called? Suds of recent radiation, offspring all gas, eight legs instead of six, propaganda instead of science, nothing pleasant for last roach scribing truth. So it's offering up that idea of being the ones suffering in the darkness, not having that inner strength to stand because we're no longer the strident many. We're the cowering sheep, so to speak. And it hits on that idea of being pushed to extinction because of a few who want to rule the whole.
I like that. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, the idea of being pushed and being controlled with a lack of free thought. Very cool. All right. And what do we have next, Rex?
We've got The World is a Dark Place by Julie Buck.
All right. The world is a dark place. Ring around the rosy. A childhood song and game, the words quite vague, yet many fell from this bubonic plague. I'm not saying darkness rules and life is pain. I'm saying to foretell your daily dose of inhumane and suffer, little person, suffer. A dark place is the world, pocket full of posies, petals to cover the stench of death. A nursery rhyme to make you shiver. Misery loiters nearby, and we fucking deliver. Purity tainted, there is no light, and no light is a reason to want to fight. Depravity never dies. Fear that. Be very scared of what you cannot see, yet moves like a feral cat. End poem.
great week, man. All right. That opening line, the world is a dark place. I got to disagree somewhat. It isn't any darker now than it has ever been in any point in time. It's just now that there is what we have as that real abundance of things being shown the light. So we're actually seeing the real darkness that's always been there, ever. And it's like that note to Greek, what the apocalypse is all about. It's not about death. It's not about destruction. It's about what the word means, the unveiling, which means we're actually getting to see what's been kept hidden from us all this time. And we think it's that darker place, but it's always been there, except now we're looking at it with eyes open. And we're getting to see that note of who and what the real reality of evil is. And now we're seeing them in a light, and they don't like it. And that note on the bottom end, depravity never dies. Fear that, yes. Fear that and stand to it, because they're more afraid of us than we are of them, because it's a whole lot more of us than them to begin with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, they're living in modern times, we do have more of an opportunity to shine a light upon the darkness, and which is an important thing, but it is also something that is scary that, you know, we have to acknowledge. But, you know, evil has existed since the beginning of time. Darkness has existed since the beginning of time. But, you know, as you were saying, Rex, it's so much more exposed now, not only because of modern technology, but because of people being willing to ask questions and seek answers for themselves. I really like how Julie fits in the lines of Ring Around the Rosie with her own lines, strong visceral imagery, a great reminder of the dark history of that nursery rhyme, and the idea that many fairy tales and many nursery rhymes had a dark history and a layered meaning to them. I really felt there were some powerful lines in this all the way through of her own. I thought where she says, you know, I'm not saying darkness rules and life is pain. I'm saying to foretell your daily dose of inhumane and suffer, little person, suffer. I thought, you know, suffer, little person, suffer is already a dark and haunting idea, but put in little person with the idea of the children suffering. It kind of makes me think of the song Hell is for Children by Pat Benatar. And how what the most innocent go through in the darkest of society's times. And I like how, like I said, she interweaves. Depravity never dies. Fear that. And that kind of goes with what you were saying, Rex, I think anyways, the idea that depravity has existed since the beginning of time and will continue on. And there are good people in this world. I truly, honestly believe this. I know good people. I mean, I know you and I know so many of our friends in LNP who are good people, but it is also a world filled with depravity, and no matter how much we find that light, those demons, those ghosts, those cockroaches, you know, will find somewhere to scurry to. So amazing right and very well done. And what do we got next, Rex?
An Owl Sonata, number 18 by Jack Blue. Raven shadows roaming low above the purple clouds of soil, or scavenging the sorry souls abandoned absently for ages, were the mere remembrances of those horrific jamborees.
Something like an ancient curse resounded and reverberated around the ashy house to fade to dissonant infinity when the window warped a bit, gravely like a shrouded face. The deadly silence whirling wide seemed to beckon me to search the ghostly hut for demon's toys, like an adventurous raccoon struggling to convince himself the world should be just a farce. The door was open laughably, but I heard a murky scream echoing around the room where I toddled valiantly and found a sword scavenging on the puppets turning purple. End poem.
Great read, Rex. I really like this one. It had a nice flow to it. As always, Jack has great word choicing with his imagery and, you know, his metaphors. He wrote to the quote, help me be human. Such amazing imagery and metaphors. To me, it told an excellent tale on evil and injustice bravely faced. And there were some great lines all the way through. I like how he brings in the ravens at the beginning, who are the messengers of death. And then that whole third stanza I thought was wonderful. The deadly silence whirling wide seemed to beckon me to search the ghostly hut for demon toys, like an adventurous raccoon struggling to convince himself the world should be just a farce. I like how that he brings in the raccoon as the curious creature, representing the idea, you know, curiosity killed the cat. The idea that we want to understand what's beyond the veil. We want to hunt those ghosts. We want to have those personal encounters with the horrific and the demonic, in order to see that there's something beyond this. And I thought the world should be just a farce. What a great word choice. Because, you know, oftentimes, you know, the world is a farce, you know, being blind to the reality of it all. And the puppets turning purple, really like that imagery. But I also like the idea of that, you know, the puppets to me turning purple, it actually makes me think of a Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and the girl who like chewed too much the gum when she wasn't supposed to, and how she was all greedy and then turned into a giant blueberry. So it kind of makes me think in that direction and how that could be a metaphor for their own greed. But it could also be the idea of like when you're turning purple because you can't breathe. And so it is at the end of life that like Pinocchio and Geppetto, that story of becoming wise to the reality of life at the end, you know, and that's just some of the different ways I interpret it. But either way, I just thought it was an amazing write on those adventures of curiosity taken through the dark shadows. So very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, the puppets turning purple has me thinking of lividity, because he starts out raven shadows roaming low. They're on the hunt. They might be the harbingers of death, but they're also scavengers. And he does hit on that note, found a sword scavenging on the puppets turning purple, the sword, a beak. So it hits that note of feeding on that which is available in the moment because it's there to eat, and all things are fed upon by something else. Now, the thought with the raccoon, kind of, because this whole thing is about the owl. It's watching. It's seeing things. It's noting what's going on all around. The deadly silence whirling wide seemed to beckon me to search the ghostly hut for demon's toys like an adventurous raccoon. Raccoons, they're scavengers too, but they get into things. They'll knock things over, get into garbage cans, whatever else. They're a little bit more curious and struggling to convince himself the world should be just a farce. So the idea of you know, they should be a little bit more wide-eyed with their thoughts, their concerns, and how they're seen from someone else's point of view. But again, that last stanza, the door was open laughably, but I heard a murky scream echoing around the room where I toddled valiantly now to the owl and found the sword scavenging on purple, puppets turning purple. So it's that idea of the back end of this is finding death in the moment.
I like that. Very cool. Great observations there. And what do we have next?
The Ultimate Family by Ryan Jeffrey Hayward. And that's yours.
And, oh, okay. Okay. Very cool. All right. We'll be the Ultimate Family, a family of three joined together in one body, more human than I am alone. Oh, that was the quote. Sorry. All right, let me try this again. Okay. We'll be the Ultimate Family by Ryan Jeffrey Hayward. Red rose dripping in blood with a smile. This day reminds her of a razor pressed to throat. She slits a fountain from ear to ear. The blood rises up to her utter delight, walks through the blood, and it is thick as mud. Her sister, Rose White, cleans up the mess, and I just write the poetry. Oh, the guilt of desire tears me with the fire or guile of my reside that refuses a buyer. And of bloody and red, dry metallic smell of blood, it smells amazingly sweet, not beetroot, but your teeth. That angelic sweet death under your sweet reminds me of first time bled, but in childhood been days. Truth gets lost in denial, the bloody of the frail, as long as we are family. It's all that matters to me. I kiss her forehead, warm to the touch. This family I bred is all I ever wanted. End poem. And, oh, my goodness, what an absolutely brilliant, visceral write. And, Rex, your thoughts?
I know he did Red Rose start that dripping in blood, but that had me thinking of Stephen King, Rose Red. It's a good story, because he does hit on later on Rose White being the other half. Supposedly his sister, but that might just be the second center of self, the alternate side of the viciousness that she's displaying, because it is only a picture of her. She's surrounded in red, and she's offering up a slight white face. But so I'm thinking it's a dual personality, one red rose and one rose white. So that one creates the spurt of blood while the other cleans up the other one, while she just writes the poetry of it. So a nice touch there, and she does hit on that note. Reminds me of First Time Bled. That kind of hits on the idea of getting one's period for the first time and finding themselves lost in the moment, kind of afraid because they haven't been spoken to about it yet. And then kind of delving into that arena of what the blood represents and how it perfects them and who and what they are, because truth gets lost in denial, the bloody of the frail, as long as we are family, it's all that matters to me. The idea of having that sanction and treaty into one's own mind, that they can display themselves in such a fashion and then have that ultimate ego to clean up after the messes while the mind delivers a touch of poetry on the back end of things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, I did like how the name and the kind of like did make me also think of Stephen King's Rose Red, which I haven't read in a while. And I think there's a movie about it that I saw, and I'll have to watch that. But yeah, I like how There's the red rose and rose white, and the idea of them being sisters, but also potentially representing the different sides of the same person. I gave this one the bronze just because I really felt like he went extra dark and creepy with the visceral imagery and how he brings forth this dark mind of a child, which makes it extra creepy with the juxtaposition of what should be the innocence of childhood. And I really felt like there was this epic dark, it was an epic dark ride on an obsession that becomes the catalyst to death, that turning point, as he mentions, that reminds me of first time bled, but in childhood been dazed, gets lost in denial, the bloody of the frail, as long as we are family, it's all that matters to me. You just feel this whole idea of this child who so desperately wants a family that she will do anything, including create it and play God to the point of getting the family that she wants to have. I really liked the angelic sweet death under your sweet breath reminds me. And then also truth gets lost in denial, the bloody of the frail, as long as we are family, it's all that matters to me. Wonderful lines on the idea of an obsession that takes over body and mind. So excellent write and very well done. And what do we have next?
What will be by Garanwi. Sound and fear playing games with life in test tube formulas for new worlds. Decanted monsters made and blended in gene pools of sugar and spice. Doppelgangers with wings and human form, flying ghosts breathing fear. Laughing terrors found behind the mind riding mares across the night, shaped in electron beams of faceted eyes, two bulging from the face. Decanted in be afraid, be very afraid of shapes of things to come. And poem.
Great read, Rex, and what an absolutely brilliant write by Garanwi. I like that this is a poem of forewarning, especially in that end line. An amazing dark write that speaks on the consequences faced when a society decides to play God. And it's not a particularly long write, but he puts so much thought into it that, you know, it was definitely well-deserving of placing with the HM. I like how this speaks on a society that plays God. When he says, decanted monsters made and blended in gene pools of sugar and spice, doppelgangers with wings in human form, flying ghosts breathing fear. Now, obviously, that's very like science fiction sounding, but, you know, where we're at in society and the things we're willing to manipulate, you know, there's just no saying how far we're willing to go and where we will be at when we realize, you know, we've gone too far. You know, the shapes of things to come. I like how he fit the phrase, be afraid, be very afraid of shapes of things to come, because, you know, in the direction that we're going, you just don't know what kind of horrific things are going to be in the future. So amazing write and very well done. And your thoughts, Rex?
Well, kind of hit on that note of what the Tower of Babel was all about to begin with, the ease of people getting together to actually work this type of magic and build something that gives them the right to rally themselves towards the gods, so to speak, and that idea of destroying that and then destroying the language to the point where you can't communicate on that level, yet it's still done, even now, for the last 100 years, at least, we've been running the note of mixing and matching, trying to create that which doesn't exist and wasn't meant to exist, because that note of sugar and spice, it's a little cliched, so to speak, but it's actually true, because you blend the gene pools in a mixture, and you can call it sugar and spice. In fact, it might even be a touch of sugar in it, and the spice being the angle of what you use to propagate the mixture itself. So it does breed something. And doppelgangers, the idea of evil doubles, so to speak. The laughing terrorist found behind the mind, riding mares across the night. I like that one for the simple notion of riding mares across the night, riding horses, female horses across the night. There's a reference there to the you need eggs to begin with, but also it's turned around because it's nightmares. It's what we can create in the mind itself, and then have the wherewithal to actually walk in that note and try and create it to the point where it does end up with that last line, be very afraid of shapes of things to come, because we're already there, growing human organs in animals, for one thing, or transplanting animal organs for human use, for one thing. There's also the note of the Chinese been experimenting with creating super soldiers by messing with the gene pool. And then there's the idea of being able in the future to choose your children. Yes, I want blonde hair, blue eyes, 6 foot, muscular, so on and so on and forth. And that notation to creation shouldn't go that route, because then you're going to walk into that note of what you create in the long run isn't actually human to begin with. It's not a self-perpetuating note to humanity. It's a self-perpetuating note to creating something which shouldn't be should not exist within our fingertips and mentality. It should always be an imaginary angle, like what you can put in books, what you can think of to for stories. It doesn't matter that it does not exist. The fact that one can think of it is one thing, but to play God on an angle where you can thereby create it is not a void one should be dipping their fingers into.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that is so true. So, very cool. And I would like to give another shout out to Silent Tree, who has been making some wonderful, nice comments on the board for everybody's poetry, and I'd like to thank her for that. So thank you very much. Good to see her. And I see now that we are going, I believe, are we going into the rites inspired by the artwork of Boris Groh?
Yep.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. Well, I want to thank everybody who wrote for the fly contest. I'm glad we were finally able to get those out of the way and delve into those. Great food for thought offered up. And all right, what do we got next?
His Eyes by Nan529. That one's yours.
Staring, staring in fear, looking out, I see his eyes. Everything around me disappears. Staring, staring, immobile, I'm looking into his eyes. all my senses were paralyzed with fear. Cold shivers run down my spine. I'm trapped. He's watching me. Glass I'm holding drops silently smashing. I'm frozen, petrified, unblinking. I'm focusing only on his eyes. It's so dark outside, and I'm just a child. Staring, forever staring, I find strength to let out a scream. My mother answers my cry for help. Shaking, I tell her through trembling words. She runs into the next room to the fireplace, running past me, a red-hot poker in her hand. She runs out into the dark garden and shouts, "Where are you, you bastard? Show yourself." Years passed, many years, all is forgot about that night. Yet somehow it still affected my very soul. What was it about Dracula? His films petrified me. Then I realized it's his staring eyes, those eyes, just like the ones locked away tightly in my memory. Although I'm old, I recall every detail as though it was yesterday. I understand how his stare really chilled me to the bone. In reality, remembering helped take away my fear, and yet as soon as it's dark, my curtains are always closed. In truth, it's a fact. His eyes really did terrify me. End poem. And she was inspired by the painting, but she was also, which reminded her of a true life experience of hers. In fact, she puts in her AN, "The artwork brought back a true memory of me standing in the kitchen getting a glass of water. Someone outside was staring in at me. My mother did indeed grab the hot red hot poker. Fortunately, she didn't caught whoever it was. I swear she would have killed him. Yes, Dracula films frightened me till I realized it was because of that night. And to this day, as soon as it gets dark, first thing I do is close all the curtains." Well, you know what? I don't blame man for that at all. And in fact, I already thought this was a dark and creepy write. It worked really well with the prompt, but to find that that was something that she actually experienced, you know, really added that extra layer to the write. And Rex, your thoughts?
"Listen to the children of the night. What sweet music they make." Oh, I love that movie. Yeah, that first Dracula movie, 1931 with Bela Lugosi. He did have the black and white. Ooh, he did have a great set of eyes that he used quite well in the movie itself. And he did offer that note of something fearful if you actually gravitated to the eyes itself and walked yourself strictly on those eyes. And yeah, it does hit on that idea. Well, yeah, shouldn't have been watching that movie. Well, Mama shouldn't have not have let you watch that movie, considering, because it kind of sounds that, I just point out, you watched it alone because Mama came screaming afterwards. And it is that idea of what lingers, what the mind can create, because it's dark outside, and you see something, the mind recognizes what they think is a shape, a face, a pair of eyes. It doesn't really matter. It could have been, at that point in time, it could have been a pair of lightning bugs in the moment simultaneously blinking off, but all of a sudden you see something else because of the ingrained note of that movie has imprinted itself on your mind. And that does leave us in frightful evenings that live long, as she points out, lives long into the latter years of one's life, too, because she still pulls the curtains. Make sure those curtains are closed when it starts getting dark out.
Absolutely, absolutely. What a scary experience to be a child and to see someone looking back at you. But I have to say, go Mom, because I totally get that going into protective mode. And I can just, I don't know what her mom looks like, but I can just imagine some woman taking that hot poker and running outside Where are you, you bastard? Show yourself. But it's interesting how these experiences, whether they're real, like a man's, or they're part of childhood imagination. Because I remember being scared of the dark as a child, and honestly, I'm not really scared of the dark, but I don't like basements. I don't like going downstairs, and there's just something so creepy about it, especially if they're open and you feel like, you know, like those hands are going to reach up. And not that I realistically think that's going to happen, but there's just something in the way the mind works. But there's these moments, whether they're part of our real life experience or they're part of the experiences we have because of our imagination, that transform our psyche and our way of thinking. And I really like how she puts a message in this of how oftentimes it's by acknowledging our fears and facing our fears that's how we overcome them. That's like the first step in overcoming them. So amazing write and very well done. All right. And what do we got next, Rex?
Let's see. We've got Wolf in Hiding by Rodrigo 22. We tip and tap and slide in apparent solitude, preferred beats resounding in our brains, lost in our own world of reaction or creativity, our ardent pupils caressing our glazed lovers. This is how our primary connection to life, our thoughts and feelings pressed into false ink, carry this magic wind to Earth's end of extremities, powerful piece of us instantly broadcasts. We know not where or when the beast appears, with its malevolent, cold, and careless stare, knocking on the thin glass of our existence, seeking our attention to consume our reality. We think that we are protected by its invisibility, believing that we are safe to passively proceed. Perhaps like sheep, we huddle in our pens, hoping that the wolf in hiding does not exist. And poem.
Oh, sit down.
Great read there, Rex. Great read. And, I really like this one. Great imagery and metaphors. He wrote to this picture with this guy on his computer with a giant monster or alien looking in and tapping on the window. And the guy's pretty much oblivious, which is a lot of the theme of the artwork. It's either there's always these giant monsters, creatures walking around, looking in windows, and sometimes the people, it seems like a lot of times it's the adults that are very oblivious to them, and then the children in the artwork are oftentimes interacting. Like some of the artwork, the children are trying to share candy and balloons. And I like how Rodrigo took this in a metaphorical direction, and the idea that we are so obsessed with what's on our screens and who's on our screens and who we're talking to across, you know, like on social media or, you know, and of course, you know, I use Facebook and I use All Poetry to keep in touch with friends and some family. And, you know, and so to me, it has its use, technology does. And I think it's a wonderful thing that we get to make friends with people, you know, that are in a totally different country. But it also is the sad reality that technology consumes so much of our time that we're not looking at what's going on around us. And I really like, this is now our primary connection to life, our thoughts and feelings pressed in false ink, carried as magic wind to Earth's extremities, powerful pieces of us instantly broadcast. We know not where or when the beast appears with its malevolent, cold, and careless stare, knocking on the thin glass of our existence, seeking our attention to consume our reality. I really like the phrase and the imagery of the thin glass of our existence, like we're just one tap away from allowing the reality of life to completely fall apart. So excellent write and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
It's the smoke and mirrors being sold something as pleasant as the entirety of human history at your fingertips. Yet, they don't bother telling you that they have stolen every fingertip, every conversation, every note of who and what you are, your passwords, your bank account numbers, the fact that this is nothing but a predatory realm developed by governments to actually infuse within you the spying apparatus, which gives them more power over you. And in that, it does leech out the note of they're even worse predators than the government themselves, although that's hard to see. But there are those, because of the angle of the picture itself, offers up a note to something a little bit more insidious, a little bit more evil, kind of hits on the idea of if you're not aware of your surroundings, you disappear in the moment. So it is the idea, if you're not paying attention to what you are doing with it, then it not only consumes you, it can make you disappear, and it can rob you blind.
That is so true. Absolutely. Wonderful comment. Very cool. Yep. And what do we got next?
We have Hunted Hunter by Dark and Dawn.
All right. Very cool. The sun descended to sleep, but no moon had taken its place. The night with no stars had me worried. I was stressed with no way to retrace. My steps through the snow, drudging on with each crunch. I had been out hunting, but now I had a hunch. Down near the ground, I listened close, heard crackling flames, and then demons rose. Up out from the fire came skeletal deer, glowing eyes burning into me, paralyzed me with fear. Unknown for the reason, I just could not run, their gaze fixated upon my hunting gun. I pointed it at them, and they started to screech. One charged my hand, knocking it out of my reach. For the skies, my hands were up as I backed slowly away, snapped a branch, woke up screaming. I stopped hunting that day. End poem. What an excellent write. And Rex, your thoughts?
It sounds like a Twilight Zone episode. I like that note, the picture itself, the skeleton deers and the hunter looking into the fire, the pit of fire. So it does, it walks a different tone of wandering on the taking of life, even though the taking of life in this case generates food to the table. So there is that note, but it kind of hits on the idea maybe they've done a little bit further. Maybe the fear they have walks a different tone and just taking a life for the food that it offers. Or maybe they've spent a lifetime doing nothing but hunting just simply for the right to put the head on the wall, so to speak, and grab the antlers and just left the carcass to rot out in the environment. That's not a great thing to do. If you're going to hunt, the idea of hunting itself is that you use, you eat, you consume, you don't waste it. So the fear on the back angle, this might be that note of waste and the ghosts of those that you left waste come back to haunt you in your dreams. I like it. It does walk in that note of a Twilight Zone episode. Reality striking back.
I like that. I like that. And you're right. It does have a very great Twilight Zone vibe. Yeah, I really like that artwork. The idea of the tables being turned, the giant skeletal deer and the flames and the hunter standing in front of them. And there seems to be this almost like standoff moment where they're all observing each other. I actually, where I live and the most people I know definitely do not waste. In fact, like my old roommate Chuck and his family, they, like, whatever meat they don't eat gets basically made into dog food. They feed it to the dogs. So there's really hardly anything is wasted. Maybe not to the point of, you know, making spoons out of bones or anything like that, but definitely all the meat gets used, and hunting is never done just for the antlers or the head to put on the wall. Not to say we don't put the heads on the wall sometimes, especially if you get a nice buck, but it's not the only reason to hunt. But yeah, the inspiration she got from this painting I thought was really cool. And in fact, I remember Christina, she commented on the contest saying how much she really liked the artwork. And I'm always glad to see when people are inspired. I like the imagery in this when she puts up, when she says, up out from the fire came skeletal deer, glowing eyes burned into me, paralyzed me with fear. And then the twist at the end with waking up and realizing it was a dream. It not only is very Twilight Zone-like, but it also makes me think of the Christmas story or Christmas Carol, not Christmas story, but, you know, the one with Scrooge. And it makes me think of that story with him waking up from his dream and changing his ways. I like how it becomes that the dream becomes that pivotal moment where one changes their mindset. So excellent right and very well done.
Yeah, we got a play too that you can take deer to. They string it up. They field dress it right there in front of you. They take the meat, portion it, cryo back it for you. What you don't want gets mixed into sausages for local shelters and nursing homes. And you pay a fee for the deer itself. Plus, they get to keep the skin and everything else left over. They'll use it to sell. So nothing goes to waste for deer down here.
That is great, especially, you know, the idea of, you know, using it to make sausage for, like, you know, the homeless shelters and the nursing homes and, you know, making sure that none of it gets wasted and it goes to help the community. That is very cool. I like that. And I have to laugh because Christina says, I thought about writing to the big scary monster that was terrified of the grandma, but went with this one instead. And I would have been happy with either one that she went with. I am glad I like the direction she took with this particular one, but I would like to see what she would do with the one. I know the one she's talking about, and it is one of the ones that really has a great dark sense of humor, because if you look at it, it is this big, giant monster, this old lady, like, holding up either a cane or an umbrella and giving him what's for. So, very cool. And all right, what do we got next?
Maggots and Butterflies by Ed Hunter. My words had spoken with care under the stars with you in mind, but what does a dog dream when he or she is asleep? They twitch, they growl, they cry, and they bark. Sometimes they run in place and they lay on the floor. As if I'm in a nightmare, like I've been here before, I feel as if a disaster's in the making, as if I'm being pursued by my shadow. Death doesn't always arrive like an explosion or a head-on collision. Death crawls step by step, inch by inch, like a caterpillar crawling on the back of your neck while you're sleeping. Now, there's a new generation deciding our outcome. Get ready for the barbed wire wrapped around your neck. It's a meal for the maggots.
Great read there, Rex. And, oh, my goodness, what a powerful, visceral imagery. Amazing imagery and metaphors. I like that title, Maggots and Butterflies. And it's interesting because both maggots and butterflies represent transition. But, you know, we think of the maggot turning into the maggots turning into flies, which then lay more eggs, which become more maggots. And it's a representation to us of death and ugliness and brutality. Whereas the transition from the caterpillar to the butterfly is a representation oftentimes of beauty and new life and personal growth. And I feel like there's something in this and the idea of, I like that he speaks on the dreaming dog, which can be which is literal, but it's also a great metaphor for us being the dreaming dog the idea that, you know, where do our minds go when we dream, and what nightmares take over, and then from the nightmare goes the reality. Strong lines all the way through, but those last two stanzas really speak on the reality of death and how eventually, no matter what outcome is decided by every new generation, eventually we all become the meal for the maggots. And I really also like death doesn't always arrive like an explosion or head-on collision. Death crawls step by step, inch by inch, but like a caterpillar crawling on the back on your neck while you're sleeping. And I thought, what a wonderful imagery, the caterpillar crawling on the back on your neck while you're sleeping. That idea that death isn't always grand and noisy. It is sometimes just quietly slips in. So wonderful, right, and very well done. And your thoughts, Rex?
Well, there's a number. The picture kind of reminds me of the final scene of New Las Vegas in The Stand by Stephen King. The note to the dog dreaming and the butterflies had me thinking of Hearts, Dog and Butterfly. That's an odd note. I feel as if a disaster is in the making, as if I'm being pursued by my shadow. That idea right there has me hitting on that note of not remembering history, so it's repeating. And this one here, Death Crawls, that had me thinking of Abbott and Costello. There was a routine. It was slowly I turn, step by step, inch by inch. So that had me thinking on them. The caterpillar crawling on the back of your neck while you're sleeping. Got that little notion of the hair standing up on the back of your neck. The barbed wire wrapped around your neck. Probably off base, but that reminds you of the gangs, those who are dipped well into the oils of torture and everything else. They have the barbed wire tattoos around their neck. and they're the ones that were coming. The meal for the maggots would be what's left in their wake.
I like that. I mean, not that I like that what's happening, but I like your connection and the observation that you made between the imagery and current times. So, very cool. All right. And what do we got next?
Grimalkin by A.R. Mundell.
Is it my turn? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Grimalkin Gaze by A.R. Mundell. Human eyes on feline fur know not what eyes do see. They glance at shapes beyond that glass and think it very twee. They think the cat watches the moon as a milk bowl set on high. Yet only feline eyes do know the horrors lurching by. End poem. And Rex, your thoughts?
I think the idea with the cat eyes is that notion of being able to see more than human eyes can. They see a bit more in the infrared realm. They see better in the darkness. They're hunters. They're really good hunters. And they see more than. It's what makes them good for what they are. They're quiet. They're sneaky, and they're quick. So they always usually end up with something that gives them sustenance. So that notation to human eyes on feline fur know not what eyes do see. We don't. We don't have that realm, that notation to see beyond the scope of what we can see in daylight. We can see a little bit in darkness, but we don't have that note to actually opening up the iris to a new colored realm where we can see more in that darkness.
Absolutely.
And the thought with the back end of it, yet only feline eyes know the horrors lurching by, hits on that idea of familiars, witches' familiars, the idea that, oh yes, that's why cats are favored by witches and other cultures, because they do see beyond the veil that is offered up front.
Yeah, I like that. Great comment. Yeah, if you click on the link in the AN, you can see the painting that she wrote to, which is of a cat looking out a window at nighttime, of a giant skeleton with glowing eyes just observing it. And so it's definitely a great take on the chosen prompt. And wonderful rhyme and flow, very smooth, great imagery. I do like how she speaks on literally how cats have better night sight, but there's also that idea, as you were mentioning, of that they see beyond the veil. They see things of the spirit realm that we don't necessarily pick up on. I also like that I learned a new word, twee, which is a British English word meaning excessively or affectedly quaint, pretty, or sentimental. So I always enjoy and appreciate learning a new word an excellent write and very well done. And what do we got next?
We've got No Way Home by Kenneth C. Perkins, and we've got the SoundCloud.
All right, here we go.
Decency lost, if not for a child whose innocence never was. My mind clutches at fleeting thoughts of the future held, my son's hands, which I dare not let go. To be misplaced and forgotten as a lonely, dirty sock. What is seen, the lesser evil between what is imagined. Navigating these littered streets, skirting skeletons of hulking monsters, no difference found among those meant to defend and those that overcome, save for the half-life of technology and the longevity of treacherous torments. not so much guiding as wandering, mapless and aimless, but to survive. Cold cans and dirty drink, no fires, for light is its own undoing, drawing darkness like lead-sketched moths. Sleep comes in shifts, left to one there is none. Death's rest will come soon enough. The world decays around us, friends abandoned if not sacrificed, family all but forgotten. It pains me to remember, yet we suffer constant reminders, maniacal meanderings of humanity's mass exodus, a depraved descent into decadent debauchery, undead animations as real as artillery blasts. Memories seen on pockmarked landscapes, laden lingerings looming as tall as tales, of Satan's demonic ascent from Hades' hellfire to the scorched earth of our former home, now just an empty shell, spiderweb cracked and ready to cave, its inner glow now demoted to a feng shui glaze of regretful reminiscence, glaring back with its silky glistening gleam like the eyes of 10 million aching scars. Fallen soldiers start stiff stares of cessation, an alien army's avarice aligned attrition, accentuating an absolute annihilation, an entitled empire's erroneous execution, carried out expeditiously.
You mutated.
Wonderful. I was, to be honest, I was waiting for end poem. But then when I realized that wasn't going to happen, I decided to unmute myself. wonderful read and write there, Kenneth. Thank you for the recording. It is very much appreciated. And just a reminder, everyone, if you're unable to call in, the next best thing is to make a recording of your poem, because then we get to hear your poetry in your voice. And Rex, your thoughts.
There's a lot going on here. The opening stanza, decency lost, if not for a child whose innocence never was. That is an inference there of not letting children grow in the moment with the innocence they're born with. They're being thrust too far into the future of what they're supposed to become rather than being led through that future itself, which is kind of hard, whether it be war, whether it's the, as he notes, the audacity to which all of a sudden it's okay to put forth that which children should not be, not see, read, hear, or ever think of. Yet it's a note that the world has gone to that angle of decadence that all of a sudden, hey, it's not a big deal to have children know what's going on with this, that, the other thing, when it isn't even within their realm to understand, or to the fact that, oh, we've got people that want to move this down to this level so children can be involved. No, that doesn't work that way either. Or that, hey, we can sit there and oh, they're not evil, period, people. They're maps. Maps? Well, yes. They just want younger children. Doesn't mean they're mean, nasty, or evil. Please. That's grooming. That's pedophilia. Get your sorry asses out of the angle of trying to make them worthy of being in society, because they're not. Then you get some on the back end. He's got a lot of great alliteration in this, too. But he also hits on the idea of war-torn. So the back end, you've got a note to after the last fight has been done. It's not a place, not a great place to be in. So innocence at that point in time is relegated to what one can squander, or not squander, what one can actually dig out of the afterburn, which might not be poisonous, which might actually offer some bit of sustenance.
I like that. I like that. Very cool observations. Yeah, this is really a brilliant, thought-provoking dark right that takes us, it's told in a sci-fi story type way with its darkness and great word choicing, visceral imagery. But I also like how it does reflect on the reality of life and society and how too often children are sent out to life through a fire they shouldn't be walking through. And, you know, the idea that as parents we need to guide them and protect them. I really liked that the emotion and the humanity brought in with my mind clutches at fleeting thoughts of the future held, my son's hands, which I dare not let go, to be misplaced and forgotten as a lonely, dirty sock. And I also like what is seen, the lesser evil between what is imagined, navigating those littered streets, skirting skeletons of hulking monsters, no difference found among those meant to defend and those that overcome. I like how he takes the imagery from the artwork, not only the individual prompt that he used, but really a lot of the artwork, and you know, sees this as both as the monsters that we created that got out of hand. But I like that opening line of that stanza, what is seen, the lesser evil, the idea that there is a lesser evil when evil is just evil, darkness is darkness, and, you know, a society that pushes into choosing the lesser evil is often one that will end up falling apart. Brilliant imagery throughout. I liked the alliteration that he had with the A's, with an ailing army's avarice, aligned attrition, as accentuating an absolute annihilation. The idea of the destruction that happens within a society that is so greedy. And amazing right and very well done. And what do we got next, Rex?
Testimonial Flight by Aaron Panda. You have a sound cloud for that, too?
All right. Well, here we go.
Testimonial Flight by Aaron Panther. Closet skeletons breathing oblivion as death stands sentry over new dominions. Old sentiments are now meaningless, and resistance is indeed a futile temptress. Residual understanding becomes but face and ghost, delivered from the ivory hands of an unwavering host. Shadows seep across unsteady ground, signaling our testimonial flight, a time when it's okay to fear fading into that long good night. Thoughts now remain stagnant in the demon's wake, as the light of existence dims over a soul free to take. Life begins sinking into the abyss. So taketh thy drama and taketh thy name. I never signed on just to be a pawn in such a soulless endgame, end poem.
Bravo, Aaron. Wonderful read and write. Thank you for the SoundCloud. It is very much appreciated. I really like how this takes a look at individuality and darkness within the individual realm, but also within the realm of society. With Endgame and Resistance is Futile, there was some great sci-fi references to this that I thought were really cool. Brilliant imagery and metaphors. I like the opening lines with closet skeletons breathing oblivion as death stands sentry over new dominions. The idea that bringing out the skeletons from the closet as individuals, but also socially. And I also like where he says, shadows seep across unsteady ground, signaling our testimonial flight, a time when it's okay to fear, fading into that long good night. I thought that was a great nod to Dylan Thomas and the long good night being that representation of death. And the idea that, you know, it's not until that moment of our own death that we'll truly have our own testimony. You know, so I liked that. And I liked how this speaks on the idea of the end of life and who you're going to be at that point. I never signed on just to be a pawn. I like that line because of the fact that I think many of us will want to look back and, you know, see that we had control over our own life, over our own voice, and not just be the pawn that wins the game for somebody else. So excellent, right, and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
I got to start with that picture because I think that explains quite a bit. It's a skeleton, skybound, with a halo around its skull and eyes that are blazing. It's looking down at a grave, an open grave. And around that grave are 12 people. There's something a bit spiritual in that note, especially when it comes to that last line, I never signed on to be just a pawn in such a soulless endgame. But the idea of closet skeletons, that you can run that inference any way you want, breathing oblivion as death stands century over new dominions. That kind of reminds me of in Magicka, the dominions, the note of one sanctuary to another, to another, to another. There's all sorts of dominions out there, whether that be the thought of dimensions or not, is something else. Old sentiments are now meaningless. That thought to how we deliver one unto the other world is not the same as it once was. Death is looked upon as easily as tossing somebody into the heap out back and letting them become the mulch that feeds the ground, instead of that there's no reverence anymore. And resistance is indeed a futile venture. A note to us, Star Trek The Next Generation, the Borg Collective, where in that Borg Collective, or the Communist Angle Collective, where nobody is important except the machine itself. Shadows seep across unsteady ground, signaling our testimony of flight. That should be the notation to a reality of passing on, a time when it's okay to fear fading into that long good night. Yes, I did get that notation, as you did, Dylan Thomas. Rage against the dying of light. Do not go quietly into that good night. Is that note of die before you should. Fight for each and every breath in the moment to live. Thoughts now remain stagnant in the demon's wake as the light of existence dims over a soul free to take. There's that note right there. If you haven't actually offered up your soul with repentance, the demon is sit there and waits easily to take that which is his, that unrepentant soul. Life begins sinking into the abyss, so take us by drama, take us by name. I never signed on just to be a pawn in such a soulless endgame. It's kind of hitting the idea right there. Take out the drama, take out the name of who and what you are. There is more to that than meets the eye. It isn't just the name. It isn't just the drama you live by. There is more to life than that itself. So if you want to be just a pawn for the end game, which is always death anyway, you'll end up as the as the devils do, taking the southward trip to the warm environment of a place you won't like.
Absolutely, absolutely, so true. And I like your observations there, not only on the poem itself, but on the artwork. Very cool. I hadn't counted and noticed that there's actually 12 figures standing around the grave. So,
well, I took cool. that as Christ being the skeletal angle with the halo around his head. The 12 apostles looking down at them.
Well, that's kind of figures. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that, and that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, the idea of the light of the sky, the moon being the halo, and the 12 figures being the representation of the 12 apostles of Christ. So very cool there. Great observation. All right. And what do we have next?
Winds of Winter by Silent Tree. That one's yours.
All right. Looks like Silent Tree has put some fun alliteration in here, so here we go. Winds of Winter by Silent Tree. The winds of winter whisper wastelands as footprints fade to fog, frozen filigree. Tall, tangled trunks, twisted tea tree talons, an engulfed eye eclipsed in echoed emeries. As I searched out the naked bone man, juvenile songs of nesting nightingales, lured lanterns, layered limbus landscapes, the mouths of morbid macabre mimicry, bare branches breathe as boneyards bathe, gander gathered grains of galloglycerin, cloven mountains wailed torn asunder, pale horses dance on moonlit graves, skeleton shadows sift silhouettes of sand, dusks, darkness, drifts, deserts, drown deep. Fortune, fingers, feral forge, forest feathers, tattooed tongues, talk, tablet, taboo, tapestries, cages of thorns, a serpent's servant silence, fanged oubliettes beckon out to dawn's abyss, crow's claw, cadaver, canvas, catacombs, raiment, raindrops, rusted riverside reveries, bloody bodies, burned black, buried broken, marbled marrow motif, martyr machines, hourglass tales of snow globe portraits, are monuments to my myriad memories. End poem. And I see she actually got a front page pick for this on March 10th. So congratulations to her on a well-deserved front page pick. And Rex, your thoughts on this poem?
Well, it kind of hits with the note, the title itself, Winds of Winter. It's about death. And it walks in that note of the angles of death, because you hit on this with the sort of after death has been delivered. So you've got the winter whisper wastelands, footprints fade to fog, frozen filigree. That note of bodies frozen in time in the moment after after battles. And I do like the two line motif that you've got running through this as well. As I search out the naked bone man, juvenile songs of nesting nightingales. The naked bone man hits at the idea of death. Juvenile songs of nesting nightingales. And it hits on the idea of sweet songs that accompany death, so to speak. And then she hits on too. Cloven mountains wailed torn asunder. Pale horses danced on moonlit graves. The idea of pale horseman was always death to begin with. And here, pale horse is dancing on moonlit graves. And then cages of thorns, of serpents, servant silence, fanged oubliettes beacon out to dawn's abyss. I like that note, oubliettes, that idea of a space which you can't escape, a prison sometimes of your own making, but more often it's a place where you're thrown into and you're left either to die there or rot, so to speak. And the hourglass tales of snow globe portals are monuments to my myriad memories. The idea of snow globe portals, and you get that flickering note of snow coming down over whatever is depicted in the snow globe. And it does offer up that note to the hourglass, the minutes of life that fade. As you turn the glass over, you're given this amount of time to live, breathe, procreate, and then die yourself. So it is all about death and how it walks and how we relate to it within the spheres of what you've offered up. Because I like the idea of skeleton shadows, sift silhouettes of sand, dust, darkness, drifts, desert, drowned deep, fortune's fingers, sparrow, forest feathers, tattoos, tattoo tongues talk, tablet, taboo, tapestry. The idea is, even in death, there is a motif. There are some taboo things that you don't do that get passed down to generation to generation. You treat the dead this way. You don't treat them this way, so to speak. And then she got that last four stanza, crow's claw, cadaver, canvas, catacombs. The idea, you let the bodies out. All manner of raptors and predators will take their profit from those that are left on the field. Fluffy bodies, burnt black, buried broken, marble, marrow, motif, martyr, machine. The idea of being reverential to the dead instead of just leaving them out to rot. Those winds of winter will always blow because death is an ever-present thing where we are concerned. Mortality sings in our bones.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wonderful comment there. Yeah, I really like this, and I'm glad she was inspired. Brilliant imagery and metaphors, great use of alliteration, a powerful look at death and the passing of time. I, too, really liked the mention of the sand, like when skeleton shadows sift silhouettes of sand. It really does speak on the idea of the hourglass and the sand falling and how that represents the passing of time and how we are coming closer and closer to death. And I like how it speaks on trying to understand death. And as you were saying, having a reverence for death. I like that she brings in the different birds, like the nightingales, which, you know, the idea of them representing that song of beauty and life, and the crows. And I also really like the imagery of cloven mountains wailed, torn asunder, pale horses danced on moonlit graves. I like that it's very epic and biblical feeling, the idea of the rider of the pale horse being that which is death, sweeping across the land. So it doesn't become just about individual death, but rather about almost like a gathering of bodies. Bloody bodies, burnt black, buried broken, marble marrow motif, martyr machines. Great alliteration and imagery there, very visceral, and a look at the idea of a society through greed has sacrificed so much, and where everything has become broken. And I like the end where it says, hungry tales of snow globe portraits are monuments to my myriad memories. The idea that we are created through our experiences. And I like how that can be the from the voice and perspective of a human, but it could also be the voice perspective of one of these machines created within this realm. So excellent write and very well done. And What do we have next, Rex?
Aftermath by Tomahawk. What finally remains of the human condition, a tragic aftermath born of deceit and sedition, the ultimately dark-grim shroud of nuclear war, decimation of hundreds of millions, and still more. I walk these streets of fire with jaundiced eyes, never again to realize the blessing of clear blue skies. Every step I take is closer, ever closer to certain hell, replete with bodies everywhere, the sight, the sound, the smell. World War III arrived with all its morbid promise thereof. Gone forever was humanity, humility, faith, and love. I hear millions of voices of millions of ghosts as I travail. There among the charred remains of society, yet I prevail. Atomic legacy is what this world has delivered in force. Radioactive fallout, complete destruction, no recourse. The acrid smell of ozone permeates the remaining air. Heading for my own oblivion, without hope, without a care. And so it is, as I walk to nowhere in this nightmare night, devoid of all emotions, for there is nothing left, not even fright. I'll succumb soon myself as the radiation takes its toll. But one good thing from this, release of my immortal soul. End poem.
Great read there, Rex. And what an amazing write by Tomahawk. Really epic. Strong imagery and metaphors. I like how he tells a tale, and yet it's a tale that's drenched and dripping in the ugliness of reality. The ending, the entire poem itself, but especially when you get to the ending, makes me think of the whole idea of when, I think there's a quote along this line of that the ones who die are the lucky ones. And so when he says at the end, I'll succumb soon myself as the radiation takes its toll, but one good thing from this release of my immortal soul, the idea that there will no longer be any suffering for him. The idea that as this person and character is walking through this world of violence, of destruction, this World War III that has been set off, and they're realizing that there's so much of their physical and mental self has been affected within the aftermath of this nuclear war. I really liked, I walked these streets of fire with jaundiced eyes, never again to realize the blessing of clear blue skies. Every step I take is closer, even closer to certain hell, replete with bodies everywhere, the sight, the sound, the smell. Amazing lines and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
Reminds me of that movie with Will Smith. He was the last person who wasn't a vampire on the earth. Yet this walks.
Oh, the one with the dog?
Huh?
Is it the one with the dog?
No. Wait a minute. No?
Oh, okay.
I think he was living in New York City. He had the blood that could cure humanity, because everyone else had been turned into vampires by some plague or something. And he'd come across some people that he actually helped ship out. And in the end, he gives himself up to the vamps. And I guess he kills them or whatever. Anyway, I forget what it is. But that was, I was halfway through the movie. This kind of hits on the idea of the last person after the idea of World War III, the nuclear end things. And, well, it does hit on how it could easily work that way and leave us and this world, say, a 10,000-year rock with not much on it until that cleansing has once more taken out the trash, so to speak, which could have, on the back end of things, be us, because, you know, people get stupid. If we can't have it, nobody gets it. And What do you know? The roaches are still here. And they've done, what, 400 million years? So, unfortunate thing is, you do get a few mad people who can actually walk a tone like this and be stupid. And the unfortunate part is, we make them that way. Or we'll give them that edge, that literal note to, hey, yeah, we'll give you all the codes. Have a little fun.
Absolutely.
But this the back end of this also hits on that note of, even though he's immortal soul, he's also hitting on the note of the fact that death, it will also die in that moment too. Because there's nothing else left to take.
Yep, absolutely. Great comment there, Rex. And the movie was, I believe, I Am Legend.
That's it, yep.
Yep, and it does have a dog in it. Not that he was the star of the movie, but he should have been. But, you know, all right, what do we have next?
A Knock on the Door by Julie Buck.
All right. Oh, yep. A lowbrow dude chilling alone, just another night in my unmanly slippers and socks and cool headphones, because music rocks. But wait, someone knocks. I don't even want to stand up to go to the door and see who that could be. I definitely feel eyes watching me. I owe no one money, a low-income old duplex with hardwood floors and solid doors. I'm damn comfy here, but feeling weird. I need a key to unlock the door, and it opens inwards towards me so my cat can see what's out there. Before I do, she wants none of that. Huge ghostly faces with saliva fangs and death and skeletal ghouls with breath of decay and rot that just won't go away. I'll agree with my tabby cat. I want none of that shit. The words welcome on my porch mat. Maybe some chat would be cool if that don't make me dead. I'll charge $10 a head. Fuck it. Make it 20. End poem. And Rex, your thoughts?
Is a bit of a strange piece, but I'll go, especially the lowbrow dude, unmanly slippers and socks, uncool headphones because music rocks, but wait, someone knocks. Right? Is this the guy who's been chipping away on his bong for too long and the imagination starts running? But I do like the idea because she hits on that note of the welcome mat and what is at the door. I recognize some of those pieces. They look like the beasts from one of Stephen King's books. What the hell was that? I'll think of it later, obviously. But they chew everything up in motion. They've got these rotating steel teeth, which kind of looks what you got right there, that eat everything. They eat time, so to speak. But he looks like he's a bit too high if he's going that route. And he goes, oh, hell, welcome? Yeah, that's not really a great addition, especially if you're going to open up the door without looking at the peephole and the cat's already cringing about the door. No. The cat's cringing already and you're opening the door, you're a fool to your own demise. But I do like the bad guy. Hey, what the hell? I'll charge him for a little sit and talk. Yeah. Okay. Low brow?
Yeah.
No brow.
Oh, my goodness. Great comment there, Rex. Yeah, I liked the dark humor of this and the idea that, yeah, you really need to pay attention to what the cat is doing. And also, I really like how in the end stanza, she writes about, you know, this character's regret of putting out the welcome mat. Like, shit, the words welcome on my porch mat. Well, I guess that's what I get for putting that out. And then the end stanza with the mention of charging $10 a head for conversation. It's kind of like going through the, it's almost like a metaphor for social anxiety. And what, you know, what would make it worth it, you know, in order to open the door and actually have a conversation? I'm pretty sure those floating heads are actually just Jehovah Witnesses, and that's why the guy doesn't want to open the door. But great write and very well done. All right. Well, I don't want to try to push another one. So we will have some carryovers, not a whole lot, but I'm not exactly sure. I think, what is it, like 3 or 4 or something like that?
Let's see. We've got, I've got Canvas of Our Times by Peter Stoneway and A Creeping Viral Fear by Daniel Deschino. And we've got,
and then
Nine Lives by Blue Wright and Nine Lives by Eric Swenson. So then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think.
All right. Well, we will move those over to next week's dark show, because they will fit there just as well. Great show tonight, Rex, as always. Thank you for being my co-host. Thank you to Silent Tree and Errant Panther and Christina for hanging on the board. Thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, is listening now, or will be listening later. We truly appreciate you all. Keep an eye out on the contests and topic boards put up by our late night poets, hosts, and hostesses, because you're sure to find something to inspire. And join us for Open Poetry with Fill My Eyes and Company at 10 p.m. and at 12:30 a.m. on Saturday, Eastern U.S. time. You can join Aphasiana for Part Sinner, Part Saint. And Saturday at 10 p.m., you can join Captain B2 and Gray Eyes Smith for Exploring Ekphrasis. And Captain B2 does have a contest open for that does need rights. And Rhett, what do you got going on for Sunday?
It's St. Patty's Day, and everybody's got a little Irish in them. So we got some songs for St. Patty's Day, including What Do You Do with a Drunken Sailor, Molly Malone, Brown Eyed Girl, and let's see, The Boys Are Back in Town, The Streets Have No Name, and a bunch of Black and Tan. There's a bunch of songs to play into, so have a bit of fun with that.
Oh, that sounds like great fun. I'm looking forward to that. Very cool. All right. Wonderful show, and have a good night, everyone.
Bye, gang.